to what they thought was the hypocritical ethics of the religions of their time and place and the rules and obligations that came with that. And so they just simply didn't want to hear about ethics from Buddhism, because what they were interested in was profound liberating experience from which they could live, naturally they live a good life. They wouldn't. And so who needs to have rules if you can just live a good life naturally from your deep realization? So, but then in the mid-80s or early 80s, a whole slew of ethical problems arose in American Buddhist communities. And in particular, some of these ethical dilemmas or problems, scandals, arose from the teachers, the very teachers who were the exemplars of realized realization. And they caused a lot of harm. And an outcome of this is that now in American Buddhism there's much more talk about ethics, realizing it's very important to talk about it and to consider ethical life, your ethical behavior, as an important area for a Buddhist practice as a whole. Now in Southeast Asia, if you go to a traditional, receive traditional teachings in Thailand or Burma or Sri Lanka, where our practice comes from, normally the teachers there would begin giving instructions in ethics. They would talk about, there's two aspects of ethics generally in our tradition. One is the practice of generosity, and the other is the practice of the precepts. And the precepts, the five precepts in the Buddhist tradition, the five important precepts for lay people, are not to kill, not to take what is not given, not to be involved in inappropriate sexual activity, not to lie, and not to be involved in intoxicants that lead to heedlessness of heedless behavior. So those generosity and these five precepts are kind of the main ethical teachings. And a person initially would get teachings in those things. And I've been to endless Dharma talks in Southeast Asia where they talk about precepts, they talk about generosity, how important it is. And they kind of drum it in that this is really important. You have to pay attention to these things. You should cultivate these things not as an ethical obligation, but rather you should cultivate them as very important practices in their own right that provide that help create a certain stability of mind, a certain stability of heart, a certain generosity of spirit, a certain level of discipline, of self-awareness, that are the foundations for being able to do really good work in doing mindfulness practice or meditation practice. What happens here in the West is that we tend to teach the meditation practice or the mindfulness practice to people cold. People in America, they want the highest and deepest and the greatest now, and they don't want to waste time with things that are kind of, you know, considered to be rudimentary, remedial, or whatever. So let's not just get over the ethics part and let's get to the real teaching. And so a lot of the teachers have kind of accommodated that kind of tendency in America, perhaps. And then, so next week I do a 5-week introductory course. If I instead offered a 5-week introductory course in ethics, very few people would come. There's more people, and ethics is now more popular in our culture than it was 10 years ago. So maybe more people would come now than they would have come 10 years ago. But it wouldn't be as popular as a meditation class. So all this is a long introduction to say. So the way I kind of do it is I kind of pretend the introductory course starts today. And so today I teach ethics. So that's what we'll talk about some. Now there's many ways of talking about Buddhist ethics and Buddhist precepts. But perhaps one way that's useful is to imagine in your mind, reflect in your mind right now, perhaps one of the deepest or greatest or whatever, strongest experiences you've had in your life of being at peace or being deeply content with life or deeply content with yourself. And it could be, you know, something happened this week or something happened this recent time or something has happened in childhood. One of the remarkable things that happened to some people, happened to me when I started doing meditation practice, I had kind of, well, the kind of, now it's a little bit old, but the kind of popular term is recovered memories. People, when they meditate, will often remember things from their childhood that they've long since forgotten. It isn't necessarily traumatic things, it often isn't. And sometimes it can be, it wasn't my case, it was forgotten experiences of wholeness that I had as a child. Delightful, warm feelings of kind of being at ease and at peace with the whole universe that I had, that didn't have any context or place in my life as a child. I had them, and they were nice, you know, and for what they were at the time. But, you know, there was no one to talk to about, no one to talk to me about such things. And so I didn't pay any attention to them and went on with my life in the way that we do. The one time when I was 14 that I kind of let a little bit of this kind of stuff kind of come out into conversation with someone, I was living up in the mountains, high kind of alpine kind of mountains. And it was a beautiful, beautiful setting with snow mountains and forests and blue skies and just spectacular vistas of the valley below. And I was kind of in awe, tremendous awe of the nature of the place and me being part of nature and being part of this great, awesome scenery. And I turned to a friend who was a little bit older and said, you know, I wonder, sitting here in this place, I wonder, what is the meaning of life? And it wasn't like I was, you know, neurotically kind of looking for some answer. It's like in the awe, you know, what's the meaning of life? You know, what's the meaning of my existence in this kind of context? And he looked at me and said, don't be silly. And it kind of shut, you know, a part of me just kind of clamped down. Like, oh, I can't make that public again. That was a silly thing to have thought about. So that doesn't, there's no place for that. So there's all this, there's a certain part of my childhood which basically because of it had no context or because it was inappropriate among my friends, that was, just kind of didn't go anywhere. It was forgotten. And one of the things that happened in my meditation practice was that some of those memories came back. And as I re-experienced some of those things in my meditation, those states, or kind of as doors into these deeper states of possibility. So you might imagine for yourself some experience you've had of great peace or great contentment now or in the distant past. And if you can't think of any, which is okay, just think of whatever level of peace that or contentment that has been accessible to you in your life or in your imagination. Maybe you remember how you felt in your body, how you felt in your heart. Maybe you can remember what it was like to look through your eyes and the kind of images, kind of the way you perceive the world in that kind of state. And then you can reflect about how would you feel if in that kind of state you were to tell a lie to a close friend, or you were going to steal something from some close friend or someone you knew, or you're going to harm them in some, either through your words or through your acts, or you were going to engage in some kind of sexual activity that was going to create the devastation that other people would learn about it. How would even thinking about the possibility you might want to do this, how would that sit with you? How would that feel? What would be the juxtaposition of that kind of motivation or that kind of action with this very deep sense of contentment and peace that maybe you kind of have remembered sitting here? How is it for some of you?
Feels terrible.
In what way?
It would be very
hurtful. So Linda says it would feel terrible, like it would be very hurtful. So in that state, maybe you're very sensitive to the cost of pain. Uh-huh. Someone else, what is your reflections on this? Yes?
I feel agitated. Uh-huh. It's like a deep calm. Suddenly things are stirred up and it dissipates.
Uh-huh. Great, thank you. What else? Yes?
It doesn't feel possible. No.
Great. Okay. That's significant reflection. Thank you. So, when would you get there?
When you're not feeling peaceful and calm.
And why is that? Why are you more likely to do something, to break one of the precepts, for example, when you're not calm, when you're agitated or scattered or harried or whatever the opposite is? We wouldn't be as sensitive to what the consequences are, perhaps. Thank you. What else? Someone else? Yes, what about it?
I want to say it's the difference between heart and mind. Actually, when you're content, your heart is open. And a lot of generosity there. And when you're agitated, your mind is taken over. And it will have you do things.
Great, thank you. Someone else.
Mine, like a real sense of real interconnection. And immediately when I started to think of something that was outside of that, there was a disconnection.
Let me see if I understand. So interconnection with the other people.
Interconnection with all life.
All life. And then doing one of these unethical things, in a sense, severs that connection. Beautiful. What else? Yes?
The things the precepts talk about are often done from a motivation of pain or anger. You hurt other people by way of sharing, maliciously sharing your own pain. You intoxicate yourself to avoid pain. You gossip about people because you're angry. All of those bad effects, those actions, typically flow from things that are the very opposite of peaceful contentment.
So that's a profound statement. And so if certain unethical behavior arises out of our own pain, what's the consequence of an unethical behavior?
More pain.
More pain. And therefore more reason. And there's a spiral sometimes. It's a vicious spiral at times, isn't it? The more pain, the more people act out of the pain or act unwisely from the pain sometimes. What else occurs to you? Some of you. Yes, Bethany.
Probably the difference between when you're feeling the love, it's not really me, and then when there's an action that's unskillful, it's more for me, or it's more self-fulfilling.
So when you have the experience of deep peace or contentment, you, in a sense, disappear. How many of you have that experience? Just kind of some sense of who you are, or self-preoccupation, or self-concern. It seems not to be so prevalent when you're very peaceful. Is that common? And when you're involved in unethical behavior, you think that you sense that, or not that any of you are, but maybe some of you might tend to sometimes. maybe, you know, it occurs to you. Maybe. the sense of self-preoccupation is much stronger.
Separateness,
which was talked about, yeah. Someone else had their hand. Genevieve.
Part of the struggle for me with the discussion is that it's dichotomous. That either we are involved in transgressions or we are involved in the same things.
Right.
And so for myself, as you were lifting the precepts, I'm quite aware of which ones I routinely think. And I feel for myself the answer somehow lies in coming to a place of some peace with the transgression and with my own tendency to fall into that. And then from that place moving into a place of letting go because it no longer serves.
Beautiful. Beautiful. So one of the things I wanted to get to this evening is that Buddhist precepts are not meant to be taken as being moralistic. They're not, you know, commandments from God in any kind of way. And so they're not meant to be some measure, way in which we measure ourselves, negatively, like, oh, I broke them all, and therefore I'm a bad person or a guilty person or all these things. The Buddhist precepts are meant to be helpful. So I think this is what the beautiful thing that Genevieve said, that she's kind of likes to see them in a way where she, I guess, to paraphrase perhaps, kind of she can accept herself, even when she breaks the precepts, and find some peace, and then find the peace, and then perhaps a deeper sense of connectedness or a place for herself. I think that Genevieve's kind of concern about this sharp dichotomy is a very good one. I think it's always very dangerous to make sharp distinctions and dualities between, you know, some pure way of being and impure way of being. But the reason I kind of did it as an exercise for kind of pedagogical purposes. If we can create a big contrast, maybe we can see some truth that resides in our hearts in relationship to all this. And I think a lot of very profound things were said here tonight about behavior and what happens to us when we kind of do unethical behavior. And the reason I wanted to have this discussion was specifically to get away from the idea that it's moralistic, but rather to see that one way to understand Buddhist precepts is that they are guidelines or fingers or guides to helping us understand how we can get back home to our innate sense of peace or contentment, which all of us have as a potential. So that takes it out of the moralistic kind of realm, right? It really serves you the best to use the precepts as a mindfulness tool, as a guide, to help you understand what's going on with you. So, for example, when I approach breaking a precept, if it occurs to me to lie or take what's not given or whatever, that to me is an indication that perhaps I've lost touch with some deep part inside of myself, some deep possibility of peace or contentment or who I really know that I am. And so rather than being guilty about that, I'll be thankful and say, oh, thank you. I'm grateful for the precepts because they showed me where I'm kind of maybe losing myself. And now's the time maybe to bring my mindfulness to understand what's going on, a very accepting mindfulness, not to be critical of what the tendency is or what's actually happened, but to bring a mindfulness back and try to learn and understand oneself from that carefully. Does that make sense? And because Buddhist precepts tend to be understood this way more often than moralistically, what you find in Southeast Asia, which for me, when I went to practice there, I found to be just blew me away. Didn't make any sense when I first encountered it. Is you find a lot of the Buddhists in Southeast Asia feel a tremendous amount of joy out of living an ethical life. The fact that they haven't lied to anyone in 2 days brings them joy. And the idea that someone would feel joy from living an ethical life was foreign to me, having grown up here in America. my assumptions, kind of unconscious assumptions, I suppose, would have been something like, if someone was living a really good ethical life, they're maybe weak, or there's something wrong with them, or what?
Boring.
They're boring. Broke. You know. In high school, junior high, whatever, somewhere in school, there was a goody-goody. Someone was goody-goody. You know, it was like, you look down and be goody-goody. Yes?
But I think also to look at it maybe a little more compassionately, it's not just about being... I mean, I think the Western tradition is about feeling guilty if you do something bad.
Yeah.
So that it's not behave properly so that you experience joy, but feel shitty because if you transgress.
Right. The guilt.
And that is sort of, it doesn't work, but it doesn't promote inner ethical feelings and behavior.
Perhaps so. And part of that, I believe, is I don't know much about Judeo-Christian tradition, but part of it in our ancient history was a judging God who was very consequential when you kind of got him angry. And I think partly we've internalized the judge, many of us, and so the guilt. And what's very interesting about Buddhist values or Buddhist culture and Buddhist teaching, it's actually considered healthy to feel some remorse or feel a little bit bad when you've broken a precept and hurt someone. That's considered healthy. What is not considered healthy is guilt. Because guilt is a form of aversion or hate. You kind of have aversion. You're kind of pushing something away or feeling bad or attacking something. Feeling bad is just feeling bad. It's just, oh, I feel bad. It's healthy, you know. It's really accepting the fact that hurt happened in the world, and the hurt had its origin in you in part. You had you were involved in it. And through your sense of connectedness with the hurt that you've created in the world, you feel kind of lousy a little bit. I mean, if you go and hurt someone, if you go have an affair with someone's, you know, wife or husband, and they learn about it and they're devastated, and you go around whistling, well, I did something unethical, that was too bad, I shouldn't do it again, great. there's something very wrong, right? I think, you know, if someone is, if your actions have just totally devastated someone, I think it's appropriate to feel, very healthy to feel, some remorse and some heaviness there, but not guilt, not self-hate. It's actually said in Buddhism that kind of remorse that is one of the guardians of the world. It's a very healthy thing for people to feel that. So that's part of, you know, ethical life too. So an ethical life that arises out of a sense of connectedness, which was a theme that some of you brought up, the interconnectedness, is not a moralistic life, but rather comes, I think, much more from what we most want ourselves, if we're sensitive. And this is one of the things I'm also trying to point to on Buddhist ethics. It's ideally an ethics that arises out of sensitivity and not out of morality. It's out of sensitivity and not out of some appropriating some rules that someone has told you have to follow these rules. And one of the great powers of mindfulness practice, or any kind of, hopefully any kind of spiritual practice, is it allows us to become more sensitive, in the way Bud said, maybe heartfelt connected to ourselves and to the world around us. That we realize that the transgression of breaking a precept is a transgression against ourselves. And do we really want to do that? If we know for ourselves this deep core in ourselves, our Buddha nature or whatever you want to call it, if we really know that for ourselves, do we want to do that kind of transgression? And I suspect that we don't, most of us. But when we get busy and agitated and full of worry and fear and running around doing 10,000 things, and as Bud said, you know, we live more, perhaps more in our mind and our thoughts, I think it's much easier to act unethically. It's much easier to say, oh, this doesn't matter so much, I think I'll just do this. I wanted to read. I found this very interesting quote, a statement. I'll just paraphrase it. There was an alcohol treatment center in Chicago, suburbs of Chicago. And they lived, this center was, I guess, near, to get there you had to take the toll roads. And you had to, at some point in Chicago, they instituted the honor system and paying the toll. And so you just kind of threw your money in a basket and kept driving. And I'm not sure how they discovered this, but they discovered that those patients who came to the alcohol treatment center and didn't pay their toll didn't get well as quickly as those who paid the toll.
Made up the data.
What?
Made up the data.
I don't know how they. Maybe they can look out their window. They can look out the window and see who was doing it, or maybe they took a survey. I don't know how they figured this out, but whether it's a mythical story or true story, I think for me it points to something significant, and that is that. The kind of disjunction or kind of separation that we cause to ourselves from perpetuating an ethical activity makes it harder for other kind of spiritual work or healing work to happen, because that kind of work requires sensitivity. So one way to understand, so Buddhist practice, Buddhist precepts can be undertaken from many different perspectives. One is simply as I talked about so far, is it can be taken as an expression of our core, of Buddha nature, or the deep possibility of contentment or wholeness that is within each of us. And so it's an expression. A person who's connected with that will naturally live an ethical life. You won't be thinking you're living an ethical life exactly, but the other people looking at you think, oh, that person's an ethical person. And you don't care whether you're ethical or not because you're just living from this wholeness. Another way, but it's a little bit idealistic to talk this way, because how many of us are constantly, you know, in touch with the deepest sense of peace and contentment that we have available to us? You know, it's, you know, it happens sometimes, and it's part of the practice, perhaps, to kind of move in that direction. But I think for most of us, it kind of comes and goes. And realizing that our life is more complicated than just always living that kind of way, another way of approaching the Buddhist precepts is taking them on as practices. And taking on practices, again, is not as moralistic obligations, but it's actually maybe through inspiration and joy, say, oh, there's a connection between living an ethical life and this deeper place inside of me that I know, this deeper wholeness and sense of possibility of sensitivity with the world. I would like to try to cultivate and be in touch with that more often than I am. It seems that when I break the precepts, I'm severing that connection. So let me take on the precepts as something intentional that I will do, make a commitment to them, so that when I start lying or stealing or killing or whatever, that perhaps I'll notice it next time because I have this limit. I said, I'm not going to go over this limit. And because I made this limit, I notice when I come up against that limit. If I haven't made a commitment to that limit, I might not notice. I'll just keep doing whatever I do. So as I approach that limit, when the motivation is there, when I've actually done something, the practice is not to get guilty, but the practice is, in a sense, to stop and investigate more deeply. What is actually going on with me? What's actually happening in this very moment with me? I find that I want to lie to someone, and I want to lie maliciously to kind of hurt them. Why do I want to do that? What's going on with me when I want to do that? Oh, there's a pain here. There's intent to hurt someone. What are the consequences when I do that? Do I really want to... Is that the most healthy way to be with my pain, is to act it out against other people? Or are there other ways, more appropriate ways for me to relate to my pain than to kind of blame other people for my own suffering? So again, so it can be with great inspiration and delight that a person says, oh, I take this as a practice of finding a way to be more connected with myself. And I think this is a beautiful thing to do with the precepts. Take them on as a practice. So the five precepts again. And you know, it's interesting. I think the five precepts are pre-Buddhist. They weren't originally just Buddhist precepts. They were just like the commonsensical precepts of India at the time of the Buddha lived. And so they're ancient, they're kind of universal kind of precepts. And so the Buddha just showed up in this culture where this is what they were doing, and he thought they made sense, and so they became part of his religion too. Isn't that nice? So you don't have to, you know, do it as a Buddhist even, because they're not particularly Buddhist. So first precept is, and the way that people traditionally in Buddhism take the precepts as a commitment is they usually do it in kind of a ritual. And they usually, the wording of it is, the first half of the phrase is, for the purpose of training, for the purpose of my practice, I vow to refrain from killing. So it's almost like a strategy rather than a moralistic thing, for the purpose of my training. And so if you break it, a precept, it isn't like this, you're not, you know, severing your connection with God. You just kind of made it a little more difficult. You've kind of interrupted your training, your practice. But you can just start your practice again. I mean, it's like learning to play the piano, right? I mean, how many times do we make mistakes? And we don't kind of get upset because we make mistakes. My son, at some point soon, is going to start to learn to walk. And every time he falls down, I'm not going to get angry with him for having fallen down. I just encourage him to practice some more. and eventually he'll get the hang of it. So the same thing, when we find ourselves in transgressing of them, then we just kind of pick ourselves up again and try to do it again, try to live ethically again. So not to, for the purposes of training, I vow not to kill. For the purposes of training, I vow not to take what is not given. It's very interesting the Buddhists want to say it that way as opposed to saying not to steal. It's a little bit more inclusive or all, kind of broader implications, I think. You don't take what is not given. If it's not actually offered to you, you shouldn't take it. For the purposes of training, I vow not to abuse my sexuality or not to be involved in inappropriate sexuality or cause harm through my sexuality. And the operating principle around sexuality for Buddhists is not to cause harm. And that leaves a lot of leeway for what is, you know, what you can do sexually. You can do basically anything you want with your sexuality, any hallway you want. Provided no harm is caused from it. Right? So, it's great. But... So Buddhists tend not to, the tendency among Buddhist cultures is to be very accepting of all kinds of religious, all kinds of sexual preferences, because, you know, preferences are not important. It has to do with, is there harm involved or not? And then the fourth one is, for the sake of my training, I vow not to lie, not to state mistruths. It's interesting that in Chinese, when they translated this into Chinese characters, they use the expression not to use rootless words. Words that are not rooted in some truth. They're rooted in our being. And then the fifth is, for the sake of my training, I vow not to be engaged or not to be involved in intoxicants, drugs or alcohol, which lead to heedless behavior. And the only variation of this is sometimes the sexuality precept, well, people will take it as a precept of celibacy. Now, for monastics, that's the case, but for lay people, it's sometimes certain circumstances, lay people will take the third precepts as precepts of celibacy. And the circumstances for this would be if you do a residential retreat, Vipassana retreat in this country. That's the expectation. That's the precept you take. They're silent retreats, and we're not engaged in sexual activity on these retreats, you know, except for sexual fantasy, which, you know, happens plenty. But there's no sexual activity, and so that's, you know, one circumstance. Going on retreat. And it's not a moralistic thing. It's just a very practical, good advice, because it's a lot more difficult to get settled in your meditation if you're involved in almost any kind of social interactions. And the more intense the social interactions are, probably the more difficult it is to really let the meditation kind of take its course. And then sometimes when people go to temples for Buddhist holidays, holy days, or go spend some time at a monastery, live in a monastery, and it's not necessarily a retreat, but just living in a monastery or spending the day at the monastery, it's very traditional to take the precepts when one first enters the monastery or the temple, and then keep the precepts while the person's at the monastery for that day, or keep them for 24 hours or something. So there's sometimes in Buddhist countries, people will take the precepts as intentional practices, but they'll do it only for short periods of time, which is a little bit schizophrenic at times. But anyway, it's also kind of nice because, you know, sometimes it can be a great... I know some people are tremendously challenged around some of the precepts. For example, perhaps with intoxicants, with drugs or alcohol. And it's a great challenge, and people need a lot of support to be able to kind of deal with that difficulty. And so sometimes it can be very powerful to go to a setting where you know you're not making a lifetime commitment. But you're going to try to make a commitment for 24 hours, and you're going to be in this monastery where it's quite supportive for that. And it can people dealing with those kinds of difficulties can develop a lot of inner strength and confidence in themselves by kind of taking it on in short times. This was in the paper this year. We arrived in Nepal. This is John Carroll. We arrived in Nepal during a festival called Durga Puja, which is a celebration of the Hindu deity Durga, who is an aspect of Devi and the goddess of warfare and other malevolent acts. The Hindu citizens of Kathmandu celebrated with parades and chaotic music making. I remember standing in a doorway on a narrow street near midnight, crushed in a crowd, watching a statue of the Admantine sow being borne aloft by revelers. I thought, not in Kansas. Another aspect of Durga Puja was animal sacrifices. The American embassy, wishing not to offend the host country, slaughtered a goat near the entrance. Photos of this event were not encouraged. I often wondered how it was handled in the expense reports. The Buddhist residents had a dilemma. They were a tiny minority in the capital city. The Buddhist part of Nepal, near Everest, the Buddhists also wished not to offend, but slaughtering animals was contrary to the tenets of their religion. So, they slaughtered melons. On Buddhist doorsteps all over the city were the pulpy remains of fruit that had been cleaved by machetes. It was important, it seemed, that it looked brutal. Not a clean slice, as though one were preparing a cantaloupe for dessert, but a great, heedless whack, with seeds adhering to the walls and pulp like pieces of flesh decomposing on the pavement. Thus, the alien goddess was appeased, and another strange artifact of assimilation was born. So, I kind of like that, you know. Do the melons instead. It's very powerful. Even if you don't take the precepts on as practices, you know, I'm going to actually, you know, change my behavior a little bit here. It's very powerful to reflect on, just be aware of when we tend to keep the precepts and when we don't. Just simply be mindful of that fact. It's extremely powerful. And then in addition, if we want to kind of try to live ethically and not cause harm, to have that as an intention is, I think, a phenomenally beautiful thing to want to do. To be able to do it is much more difficult. And one of the things I find very inspiring among Buddhists in America is the concern and interest and inspiration to want to try to live ethically. In an environment where sometimes it's very hard to live ethically, and people will come to me thinking I'm an expert on these things, and say, "What am I supposed to do with my ants in my kitchen, or the cockroaches, or the termites that are, you know, destroying my house?" I'd rather not give any, you know. The Buddhist answer, of course, is say goodbye to your house. But you know that, you know. You can't really, you know, or it's like, you know, go out and buy melons, you know, and move out of your house and next door build a cement, you know, brick house or something, and let sacrifice your house to the ants or the termites. But realistically, I think, you know, that doesn't make sense to let our house kind of disappear to the termites. So, I'd rather not be in a position where I'm giving solutions exactly. But what I'm delighted with is the fact that people are interested in this, and the fact that people come and say, you know, I have this problem with ants or termites or snails in my garden. It seems kind of petty compared to the kind of ethical things people can really do in our culture. But the fact that people have this kind of concern and sensitivity, I think, is really beautiful. And when it comes to more important things, they're more likely to be more thoughtful and more considerate. And one of the things that can happen when we're more thoughtful and considerate is that sometimes alternative solutions can arise to challenges that we're facing. So for, I mean, another kind of simple example is with mice. There can be have a heart mice traps. When we moved into our house where we live, there were mice. And we went out and bought plastic tubs for our food. We kept all everything in sealed plastic tubs. The neighbors who moved in next door had mice too. They didn't do that. And soon they had rats. And soon they had holes in their walls. And soon they had rats living in their oven. And all this stuff happening. And eventually they got, you know, exterminators that came with traps and poison and stuff like that. But we simply covered our food. You know, it's... What? Yeah, I've heard, you know, so people get these have a heart mouse traps and they take them to, you know, they take them somewhere else. So, the fact that people are interested in this topic and interested in exploring, you know, ways of living more ethically, I think to me is a source of great inspiration. I've talked a lot. Do you have any comments or any questions before we sit? Take maybe 5 minutes. Stephanie.
I have one phone. I come down on the train every Thursday to meet Stephen. Sometimes the conductor doesn't come and collect your money. And so what I do is I put it in your Dane's basket. It makes me feel better.
In the where? Which basket?
In your Dane's basket.
Oh.
Looking for him.
Not looking for him.
Not looking for him.
So you can go the other way.
So anyway, you get.
So what do you do when a storekeeper gives you back too much change? What do you do? What do you do when? What are some other examples of things like that? What do you do if you borrow someone's pen? And you leave, and you're halfway, half a block away, and you realize that you have their pen. What do you do? Depends on what kind of pen. What do you do? I mean, I'm just kind of thinking of simple examples. You know, maybe you could. You know, some of you have much bigger examples in your lives, but it's very simple ones. Yes.
I had an interesting experience last week. My neighbor called me to her house, and she said, "I have a present for you now, because I know you're Buddhist." This is a book called Buddhism in America. And she gives it to me, and I'm looking to see. You authored an article in here, and the various other teachers I had done so as well. And then she chains into this conversation, "Oh, the publisher sent me two by mistake, and it's too much of a hassle to return this." You know, and it was very embarrassing. So I couldn't confront her immediately. I took it home, and then a few days later I brought it back and I explained to her why I was returning the book. And her feelings were kind of hurt initially, but it was a very good exercise because we talked it through. And what she didn't tell me, my assumption was it was a form of stealing, so I was returning the book. What she didn't tell me was that the publisher invoiced her for two and she paid for it. So, but it was very interesting watching my reaction and how to handle it tactfully.
I think it's beautiful, a beautiful thing when someone feels that kind of awkwardness, because it means that there's some kind of something inside of you is sensitive to something more, something very profound and deep.
Right, I could tell it was meaningful for her to give this to.
Right. And the
but
same time,
I had to deal with the issue.
Yeah, it's a so I think it's great that you have to. I mean, it's beautiful that you ended up having to deal with it. The fact that you were sensitive enough to this kind of issue that it was a problem for you,
right.
You know, and you had to struggle with a solution, is a beautiful thing.
But
it's not comfortable.
It was so interesting how it worked out because she didn't say the crucial thing to me immediately at the time she presented the present. You know, that I've been invoiced for this too by mistake, but I'm paying for it. Mm-hmm. And I had made the assumption, because I know a lot of people who, if a publisher does that or they get an extra CD or whatever it is, a lot of them will just keep it.
Yeah.
And I thought that would happen.
It was.
It was a wonderful experience for both of us. Yeah.
Yes.
I was thinking of it from a different point of view. I belong to a health club, and I was given a very lovely watch, and I left it in the shower. Went back a little while later, and it was gone. And I found myself just thinking terrible thoughts about this anonymous person. How could someone take this watch? You know, and I kept going back, surely someone would turn it in. And I actually found the work I needed to do in terms of just letting go of that thought and not judging that activity, my practice, so to speak, as opposed to kind of the other side that we've been talking about.
I think that's that.
Internalizing the judge,
right.
That you were talking about earlier is a lot of where my work is.
Thank you. That's happened to me a number of times where someone has stolen from me. And then I've practiced with similar things inside of me. What is my reaction, my response? You know, I'll suffer. And how much of that suffering is necessary? You know, do I feel, you know, I blame myself for being foolish, having left whatever I left there? Or do I feel, you know, all kinds of things? And what my tendency nowadays when this happens is that I realize, I reflect on the consequences for this person, and some hope that when they do wake up, that this particular activity functions for their actually helps them wake up more. It actually helps them become a better person, rather than that they feel more guilty from it. And then one other reflection I have is, I really hope they needed it more than me. I really hope they needed it more than me. Uh-huh. Yes?
Well, I had an interesting experience in that from the other end of it myself last week. I own a small store, and I was at work last week, and a girl who was probably, 15 or maybe 16, came in with her girlfriend and wanted to know if I was the only person who worked at the store, and I said, pretty much yes. And she said, well, she was a recovering alcoholic, and one of her steps was to make amends for things that she'd done wrong, and she had a necklace that she had stolen from my store. And it was so sweet. And I got all teary when she came in. And she said, well, what do you want me to do? And I said, well, just give it to me. I said, that's fine. And I asked her her name and shook her hand and, you know, said I thought she was just great. It was really, so it does, you know, work eventually. I think people, there is some kind of karmic retribution or whatever.
And it helps if you, someone like you in your shoes, was able to receive that with some generosity, get reviewed back, and not get angry or critical, or so again, really kind of accept that person as, you know, for what they're trying to do. And it's really beautiful to be human beings are so beautiful. Mm-hmm. If we all knew how beautiful we are. We would all fall down and bow to each other. So with that, let's do our about 5 minutes of sitting to end the day. So I hope that you can maybe reflect a little bit about the connection between a mindfulness practice and an ethical life. That if a synonym for mindfulness is sensitivity, maybe you'll see the close connection between the kind of discussion we had today about ethics and the practice of mindfulness. And I want to mention again that this Saturday there's a one-day class retreat on Buddhist teachings and practices on death and dying. That there's a flyer for out in the hallway, and it's happening down the street in St. Mark's. And then next Wednesday evening is the beginning of a five-week class on integrating practice and spiritual practice in one's place of work, with one's work. And a lot of the issues around precepts, and I think, will come up in the course of that class also, because that's a very juicy subject at work for many people. So thank you all very much. Thank you.